Stand by while NCLA cuts through the noise to signal abuse of administrative power. This is Administrative Static with Mark Chenoweth and John Vecchione.
Welcome back to Administrative Static. So, Vec, we have another interesting matter at the federal level this time that NCLA was involved in this past week. We filed comments with the United States Department of Education over its proposed priorities in American history and civics education. These were some priorities that the department put out 1 month ago on April 19th, and comments were due 30 days later. And usually when the department puts out something for comment, it's a rule. But these proposed priorities are ostensibly not a rule. They're just priorities. But by putting them out for notice and comment, they're, trying to make it feel like a rule, or at least put them in a position to say later that, hey, they allowed people to have their say on these. And it wasn't, it was something that did go through some sort of notice and comment process. But in any event, what these priorities are is an effort to try to coerce state and local curricula into incorporating certain concepts and ideas into the curricula that might not otherwise be there. And we could talk, we could spend the whole segment here talking about all the problems that there are with these curricula, and a lot of the other commenters talked about the problems with these curricula, which seem to be based on the 1619 Project, which is the New York Times effort to trace American history from the year when African slaves were first brought to Jamestown Colony, rather than from 1609, which I think is the founding of Jamestown, or 1620 when the Mayflower Compact happened and the Pilgrims landed at Plymouth Rock and so forth. Not just trace it from that date, but to emphasize all of the subsequent effects that have occurred as a result of slavery, and really focus on which obviously has a huge impact in American history, but to really focus on it in a way that permeates every topic and every subject and everything that goes on in the classroom. And there's a lot of concerns about that, with the divisiveness that it creates in the classroom and the sorting of students in a way that, frankly, I thought Brown v. Board of Education had done away with permanently. We shouldn't be resegregating students based on some sort of curricular priorities, but that's part of what this proposed curriculum would entail as well. But NCLA didn't really focus as much on the substantive concerns with the curriculum, because we don't think the Department of Education is legally allowed to even issue priorities like this. As part of the organic statute that created the Department of Education, and our letter is on our website for folks who want to look at the nitty-gritty and find out the specifics about this. But the organic statute that created the Department of Education included language from Congress making it clear that control of school curricula was being left to state and local authorities. The founding statute says it is the intention of the Congress in the establishment of the department to protect the rights of the state and local governments and public and private educational institution in the areas of educational policies and administration of programs, and to strengthen and improve the control of such governments and institutions over their own educational programs and policies. The establishment of the Department of Education shall not increase the authority of the federal government over education or diminish the responsibility for education, which is reserved to the states and the local school systems. So that language pretty clearly shows that the federal government does not have control over the curriculum and can't issue something like this. We and also Mark, talk about, go ahead.
Well, and Mark, it would be the same. These proposals, and I understand the proposals are also saying that free market economics are not, have some problem with them, I think is part of the background of this as well. But if the federal government wanted to say that free market economics has to be taught in the school, in every school in the country as a good, it would be the same thing. What you'd have is the federal government saying what can and cannot be taught in every school in the country. And that statute you just read is made to prevent that.
That's right. That's right. That's statutory language. And there's been a subsequent Supreme Court authority as well, interpreting some earlier language before the Department of Education was founded. There was the Title I of the 1965 Elementary and Secondary Education Act. The Supreme Court interpreted that in a case called Wheeler v. Barrera in 1974 to say that act demonstrated a pronounced aversion in Congress to federalization of local educational decisions and a clear intent to leave decisions to the local and state agencies. So there's not only statutory authority from the organic statute founding the Department of Education, there is Supreme Court authority interpreting the prior statutes, Elementary and Secondary Education Act. And then there are other subsequent statutes as well and subsequent court cases looking at this, and they all reach the same conclusion. This isn't something that's that we often have where we see some courts finding things one way, some courts finding things another way. It's quite clear that the federal government does not have authority over curriculum at the state and local level. So what's this all about? What? And you might say, well, they're not dictating the curriculum, Mark. They're just saying, hey, if you want federal money to go to your school district to teach history or civics, then you have to comply with these directives. And what the proposed priorities state is that applicants will be given priority for federal funding if their projects, A, take into account systemic marginalization, biases, inequities, and discriminatory policy and practice in American history, B, incorporate racially, ethnically, culturally, and linguistically diverse perspectives and perspectives on the experience of individuals with disabilities, C, encourage students to critically analyze the diverse perspectives of historical and contemporary media and its impacts, D, support the creation of learning environments that validate and reflect diversity identities and experiences of all students, and E, contribute to inclusive, supportive, and identity-safe learning environments. So the department tries to portray those priorities as content neutral, but they're not, and they cite the 1619 Project and quote folks like Ibram X. Kendi, who is a promoter of critical race theory. So it's clear what the goal is. And the reason this isn't allowed is because this is coercive. Most state and perhaps all state and local school districts, state education authorities and local school districts depend to some degree on federal funding. And so if you're making that federal funding depend on going along with certain curricular priorities, then that is the way that the government influences curricular priorities. So to say that, well, this is just funding, this isn't really coercion, misses the point. This is coercion. This goes to precisely the instrumentalities that the federal government uses to try to affect things like in this case, proposed priorities for the curriculum, which I have trouble saying, Vec. Apparently, proposed priorities.
Well, that was a toughie. I will also say the idea that it's content neutral is absolutely madness when you read any of the people they're citing, because all those people say we have to have a complete change in what we teach. I mean, that is the whole point of those authors, that we have to have a complete change in what we teach. So it makes no sense to say that the federal government is being content neutral and, oh, this is designed to mirror these thinkers, which the commentator and thinker Wesley Yang calls the successor ideology, even. Rather than critical race theory. But the fact is, the whole point of it is to change what you teach. And if the point is to change what you teach, the Department of Education is not supposed to be doing that. It's supposed to be, at best, improving the ability to teach, not what's taught.
That's right. And the Constitution is the other authority for this, right? The Constitution does not give the federal government authority over state and local education. And we know this from Pierce v. Society of Sisters. We know this because the spending clause permits Congress to pay the debts and provide for the general welfare of the United States, but it limits Congress's authority to condition the payment of federal funds on state and local actors engaging or refusing to engage in certain behavior. And the Supreme Court has said that if Congress wants to try to do that, it has to speak unambiguously if, you know, if it wants to try to create a condition on the grant of federal monies. But here, Congress did speak unambiguously in the opposite direction. It said unambiguously that this is to be left to state and local authorities. And so for the Biden Department of Education to try to step in and use these proposed priorities to direct federal funding is just unlawful. And that's the unworked part.
And this is the worst thing. We talk about the administrative state all the time, and sometimes it's operating where Congress hasn't operated, and it's using gray areas and saying, well, somebody's got to do something, so we'll do it. And you know, courts.
Right, fill the gap, right?
Yeah, exactly. So a lot of time, and I don't buy that either, but I will say this. When Congress has spoken, and spoken a long time ago, and spoken consistently in Democratic and Republican Congresses for something like 40 years, to have an administrative agency say, well, you know what? We're going to go in the complete opposite direction of our animating statute just shows you that the incredible arrogance of these organizations that are, fourth branches that don't feel they're bound by the Constitution or the laws or anything. They think that they have their mission and they can do it any way they want, regardless of what Congress wrote. And that is so dangerous in a republic. It's not even funny.
No, it's not. And it goes to the rule of law, right? We have laws that have been passed in this country about how education is supposed to be taught and who's supposed to be in charge and so forth. And the Department of Education is trying to just steamroll those and instead implement something because it wants to, because it likes this curriculum better. I agree with a lot of the negative things that folks have said about the substance of these priorities. But the main thing that NCLA has focused on is that this is just plain unlawful and inconsistent with prior statutory authority, prior precedent, and the United States Constitution.
Well, I want to talk about a Supreme Court case that came out this week. We didn't work on it at NCLA, but it does have to do with administrative power. And it is somewhat interesting. And in a past life, I did work on this issue. And I always love it when the IRS loses. I have to say it's a dirty little secret, but it is true. And what happened in CIC versus IRS, I won't get into the details because I think even accountants who work in taxes will fall asleep. But this was tax week, and the IRS suffered a blow from a really outrageous litigation posture it had taken. So what happened was CIC had certain insurance type contracts, I think is what they are. But the IRS created reporting requirements that were extremely onerous and cost tons of money. So I'm just going to use an example. So the reporting requirements would cost a company maybe $60,000 to collect all the data and make sure they were doing everything right, even though there might be no tax at the end of it. So I'll say that's the fact pattern. But years ago, right after the Civil War, the Congress passed the Anti-Injunction Act, and the Anti-Injunction Act's been amended a few times, but it always says the same thing. If you want to challenge the IRS taking taxes from you, you have to pay the tax and then go to war. So you pay the tax and then you can fight the IRS, but you can't.
No legal shortcuts to paying your taxes. You can't
right.
just delay,
you can't,
delay it
you,
by seeking
you
an injunction.
You can't say, Your Honor, I got a really good case. Enjoin the payment of my taxes. Don't let me pay taxes. And of course, this was passed at a time where, you know, those taxes might, they weren't going to deficit spend. So they needed their taxes. So in any event, the anti-injunction.
Well, also passed at a time when judges might have sided with taxpayers a little more frequently than they do now.
So the point is that the Anti-Injunction Act was to stop people from gaming the system, from saying to the IRS, well, we'll enjoin you from collecting this and then delay for years as the court system went on. And that's how it was mainly used. But as it has developed, the administrative state, in this case, the IRS, raises the Anti-Injunction Act anytime you sue them. It was almost like, well, they didn't de-ice their sidewalks outside the IRS and I slip and fell. And they said, well, this will slow down our tax collection. Now, I'm obviously joking there, but
not much.
They would raise it for everything. The IRS would say almost as an immunity. It's as if Congress had passed an immunity from what was going on. But CIC said, wait a minute. We don't even know what our tax is. Our tax isn't even due. We just want to challenge this rule that has criminal sanctions, by the way, because it's the IRS, right? So there's civil and criminal penalties if you don't do what they want. It's never like, oh, if you fail here, we'll give you a warning. That's not really how the IRS operates in its rulemaking.
We'll charge you 10% more or something like that. No,
exactly.
We're going to throw you in the slammer.
Exactly. So the IRS puts in, you know, really ruinous notification provisions and data collection, which always sounds harmless until you're collecting the data and trying to figure out where it is and what it is and all the rest of it. Some of you small business owners out there might know what I'm talking about, but collecting and holding on to data and making sure it's the way the IRS wants it is not always an easy task given the size of our economy.
And it has to be accurate because then otherwise you're submitting false data to the government. So there's a lot that goes into complying with those data.
That's exactly it. And in this case, I think some of the collection amounts would be more than the IRS is going to collect at the end. So they went all the way up to the Supreme Court and at a former organization, we filed amicus briefs in the appellate courts, because this was all over the place. It was in many, many appellate courts, and there was a split amongst the circuits. But the Supreme Court took it, and in a beautifully written opinion by Justice Kagan, I really like it, when she's setting up the problem of whether this is under the Anti-Injunction Act, whether this is about the collection of money or the collection of data, she said that, if you had to pay a tax under this rule immediately, this case would be a cinch. And she used that word. I haven't seen a cinch in a Supreme Court opinion. And I think it's kind of colloquial, but I liked it. And she says, but here's the real thing. And she went through the IRS's position and she just dismantled it one piece at a time. She talked about why the Anti-Injunction Act came into being, what it's there for, what the IRS had done with this rule. This rule was kind of, she didn't say this, but it was sort of a Schrodinger's cat, which is the idea out of physics that you don't know till you open the box whether you have a, whether it's there or not. So you don't know if you owe a tax or not. Nobody knows. So how can this be stopping them from collecting money? It's not like the IRS says, here, you owe this. This law requires you to pay X amount. It says you're going to collect these documents, and at the end of the day, we'll tell you whether you owe anything. So she dismantled the IRS's position. And why this is so important, and it comes on tax week, which they get to decide when they release these things, Mark.
That's such a good point. I hadn't even thought about that.
Right?
That's a little bit of a brushback pitch, you think?
That's what I think. I think the Supreme Court gets to decide when it releases its opinion. And COVID changed. So for once, the tax day wasn't April 15th. It was in May. And yet they released it the very week that all the taxes are due, which I just find hilarious because it's not like they have an IRS opinion every week, right? It's not like they do this all the time. So I do think there's someone up there with a sense of humor in it, and I think it's probably Kagan because she's got to put the final jot on the thing, right? Anyway, so
well, someone else might have held it for a couple of weeks, saying, "You know what? I just need to sit on this just a little bit longer." But you're right; somebody has a sense of humor.
Somebody did, and
I'm happy to credit Kagan.
And so what? So the IRS has really, I think that this is very much like we talked about the FTC disgorgement cases, and that the FTC took an outrageous position. Totally non-statutory for many years and just pressed it and pressed it and pressed it until it got to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court said, no, you don't have disgorgement. And now they say, oh, what are we going to do? Well, the IRS, once again, what has it done? It's done the same thing the FTC did. It's taken an unreasonable position. It's made it its litigation strategy, and it's forced it all over the country. And once again, Mark and I, particularly in this episode, we've talked about this arrogance problem that at any point they could have taken the brakes back, They could have tapped the brakes a little bit and maybe got a better outcome for their client, which is, of course, the IRS. But they always want to maximize administrative power where whatever the statute said, they have an outcome they want. And they don't want to be sued by the taxpayer. And even if the taxpayer is complaining about their forms or complaining about something else they've done that's violative of some other law, they say, anti-injunction, you can't sue us. And I think that this is a brushback. And I think it's going to have wider application because it is one of these cases that we've really tried to push here at NCLA that you have got to look at the statute. You can't just say, oh, they're doing good things or they have, you know, some kind of general authority out in the air somewhere. They have to have their authority from the statute. They have to have their protections from the statute. And they can't go beyond that because they don't have independent – they're not a constitutional body, right? They were created by the Congress. So they only have the protections and the power that Congress gives them. Even though they're the IRS.
Unless you count the 16th Amendment.
Well, that doesn't say the Internal Revenue Agency. It says the federal government can collect the income tax. But anyway, yes, exactly. There's, whenever anyone tells me that constitutional amendments are too hard, I said, they actually had a constitutional amendment that was pushed by both parties and that passed that put the income tax in the Constitution with, you know, all the majorities you need. And we look at it now and we go, how could that have ever happened?
But because it was only ever going to tax the top 1%, John, don't you know?
Millionaires.
Only the millionaires. Yeah.
And maybe,
only
maybe
the Rockefellers.
John D. Rockefeller, right? Maybe there was one billionaire.
Yeah. And people fell for it back then too.
They did. But the fact is that the IRS did get a brushback pitch and it did get it during tax week. And
Well, this is going to affect some of our cases, Vec. You know, we have the case Harper v. Reddig where our client up in New Hampshire is suing over the Bitcoin currency that the government's been trying to come in and take away his or execute a search on him. And the Anti-Injunction Act has been part of the debate in that case, if I'm not mistaken.
It has been. And that's why I use that cinch, that the hypothetical that Kagan uses, that, you know, if we had this case, it would be a cinch. I think that's our case there because there is no revenue collection. They just want to monitor. They want to check you out if you have Bitcoins. Now, this week, Bitcoins took a terrible, terrible hit, but they didn't go away. Just the market fell. But the fact is the IRS doesn't care about that. The IRS is whether Bitcoins are worth a dollar or $60,000, they are putting in monitoring and data collection. It's data collection, just like the CIC people were dealing with. So yes, I do think for that case that it's going to be a biggie and that the court's going to be looking at it. And the First Circuit's going to have to do some thinking. So, Mark, the IRS takes a hit. The governor's unconstitutional powers take a hit. A good week for administrative static.
And a good week to close it with Van Morrison's lockdown music.